Welcome to episode 61. I'm Stuart McCullough, I'm the CEO of VHAA. I'm starting with this week's industrial roundup and in particular with community health. It's a critical week for community health in terms of bargaining. Proposals for resolution have been circulated amongst the members, including proposals for resolution for the medical scientists agreement, which covers dietitians, pharmacists and psychologists, as well as the health and allied services agreement. The medical scientists' proposal will be discussed on the 1st of May with instructions to be received by the 3rd of May. This will assist us in discussions with the relevant union. Regarding health and allied managers and administrative officers, there are also timeframes for response and resolution of that matter. One of the critical items for members to turn their mind to concerns the claim to integrate the clerical structure with the administrative officers' structure. With respect to allied health professionals, we returned to the Commission on the 1st of May to continue bargaining with the assistance of the Fair Work Commission. With respect to our health services managers, we had a meeting of the Dental Reference Group on Monday, 30 April, and our Metro HRIR managers meeting occurs this week. Also meeting this week is the overarching reference group. Finally, on the VHA community app, you'll find photos of a recent event that we conducted regarding flu vaccinations. Representatives of VHAA, ANMF, HWU, HACSU and VARPA each got their flu shots together. The photos from that event have since been distributed by each of the relevant organisations through their respective social media channels. The reason for doing that concerns the Service Delivery Partnership Plan. Under each of those service delivery partnership plans is an obligation to seek to increase the levels of flu immunisation. Having considered that for some time, we decided that the best way to do that was to hopefully be an example and to get our shots done together. Those photographs can be utilised for you in terms of your campaign to increase the levels of immunisation if that's of use. As always, all of our activities are summarised through the VHA community app. And that's it for this week's Industrial Roundup. Welcome to the Weekly Update, where we go in depth with a particular subject. And joining me for this week's discussion is Senior Workplace Relations Consultant Daniel Pullum. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you, Stuart.
Daniel, you know how it works. Would you reveal the clue for this week's subject for discussion?
Of course.
So for the benefit of those people who are listening to this podcast rather than watching, could you describe what it is that you see?
We have a Puma sweatband, a Reebok, what looks like a extender band.
I think the technical term might be TheraBand.
TheraBand, and a Dunlop 3 kilo dumbbell.
I think it's 30 kilos, Daniel. And based on the based on those particular clues, what would you say that the subject for this week's discussion is?
Look, I really wouldn't have a clue.
You have to try. And that of itself is a clue.
Could it be training time?
Daniel, yes it could. Today's subject for discussion is training time. However, I feel in order to have this discussion appropriately, we should get changed. Or more specifically, you should get changed.
I don't think so.
Well, that is awkward. Do you want to flip for it?
No. So it's important to note, Stuart, that the definition of training time is unchanged from the previous agreement.
So it's the same as the last agreement, but just remind people who are watching and listening, what is the definition for training time?
So the training time is a rostered period of time that's made available to registrars only under the Doctors in Training Agreement for 5 hours per week that's dedicated for training, which is free from service, with the exception of calls about medical emergencies and disaster situations.
So we've identified that that hasn't changed with the new agreement. Have the forms of training time changed with the new agreement?
No, so the forms of training time remain the same as the previous agreement. Noting that the types of activities that are undertaken by a registrar in training time each week must be agreed between the registrar and the health service. Now these arrangements can be taken on or off site, and these can also contemplate unplanned or impromptu training opportunities.
I noticed that the training time provisions are now a standalone clause.
That's correct. So the previous agreement, members would note that the training time provisions existed within the definition section of the agreement, and it was referred to within the hours of work provision as well. Given the complexity of training time and the complexity of it as a clause, the parties agreed that it required its own standalone clause.
So on that basis, Daniel, is it fair to say that the structure of the training time provisions has altered?
That's correct. The clause is separated into three key components: the arrangements for rostering and taking of training time, how to roster training time, and what occurs where training time cannot be rostered.
So let's go through the first of those elements, the arrangements for rostering and taking training time protocol.
So the clause provides what must occur when training time is being arranged, and this includes the requirement for training time to be rostered in a period of 5 hours per week, unless otherwise agreed, and we'll get to that sooner, in blocks of no less than 30 minutes duration, published appropriately in accordance with the training time clause, and arranged in a manner that contemplates doctors that work night shifts and weekends.
You know, it's hard to tell, but I can almost feel as though those words are probably on the screen right now. I understand that the clause also requires that there's a discussion between the health service and the registrar at commencement.
That's correct. So the clause requires that the health service discusses the forms of training time available to registrars at the health service and most appropriate method of arranging and rostering training time at the commencement of the registrar's employment or at the commencement of their rotation.
So this sounds like a critical point, and we'll just go over that, that at commencement the health service needs to arrange a time with the registrar to discuss the format of training time available and the most appropriate method for training to be arranged and rostered.
That's correct.
And our feedback with regards to that, especially from our rural and regional health services, was that there should be greater flexibility with respect to the arrangement of training time to allow it really to be delivered in ways other than 5 hours per week, so long as the right number of hours is delivered overall. Was that quest for flexibility achieved?
It was achieved, and we thank our rural and regional members for their feedback and contribution with respect to this item. The clause allows health services and registrars to arrange training time in a manner that provides a demonstrable benefit to the registrar, but also ensures that the quantum of training time is equal to what they would have received if it was arranged in 5 hour per week blocks.
The key thing for me is the certainty that it's actually been given, and that organisation, organising the time, however it's to be delivered, is a crucial factor to that success.
Agreed.
So a health service and a registrar can agree, instead of 5 hours per week, for example, that the registrar might receive a 10-hour block in week number two.
Correct.
And I understand that there's a requirement for changes to roster training time to be recorded in writing.
That's correct. So any change to roster training time has to be recorded in writing by the health service, with that written record being available for inspection.
Could you expand on the second component then, how to roster training time?
I think the key change pertaining to how training time is rostered is that the clause details that training time must be published on the document that is relied upon by all clinical and non-clinical staff within the health service to identify a registrar's hours of work, such as a roster or another agreed document.
It's interesting just in terms of that description that's being given, and it really goes to the purpose of that requirement, that the purpose of that requirement is that people within the health service are aware when the registrar is on training time to reduce the likelihood of disruption.
Correct.
I note that health services sought to have flexibility with respect to training time to take into account the variability on time card and payroll system capability. Was that achieved?
It was. So the clause provides that where current rostering technology does not allow training time to be adequately published in the roster, another agreed document may be utilised, provided that the document is relied upon by clinical and non-clinical staff within the health service to identify that registrar's hours of work.
So what should the rostering arrangement or other agreed document identify?
So it should identify start and finish times for that registrar's training time period, and it should also identify the appropriate alternative clinical contact following the forfeiture of the registrar's pager for the duration of the training time. But that can only occur where the forfeiture of the pager doesn't create an identifiable clinical risk that it cannot be managed in a registrar's absence.
So I think those factors are really important, and it's really emphasising the need to avoid disruption. But to clarify, a registrar may still possess their pager while undertaking training time if there is an identifiable
clinical risk that cannot be managed during the registrar's absence.
That's correct.
So we would recommend that people actively turn their mind to that rather than simply assert that there's always such a risk. It actually requires more than that from people who are administering that clause.
That's correct.
And the final component that you identified of the three components, what occurs if training time can't be taken as rostered?
So where a registrar is rostered to undertake training time and they are unable to be released, training time or training time is interrupted due to a genuine medical emergency or disaster, or simply the scheduled training time cannot occur for any other reason, then the health service must reallocate training time to be undertaken by the end of the following pay period or at the registrar's election, a later roster period.
Is that an example of a circumstance where there might be a change to what was rostered?
It would be, and that roster change would need to be recorded in writing.
So that's a reference to a change to what was planned?
Correct.
But what if, despite best efforts, training time can't be taken at all?
So at the end of the four-week period following the originally rostered training time, the period of training time has not been taken, then the hospital must pay the doctor at the applicable overtime rates for the time in the roster where work was performed in excess of ordinary hours, and any portion of training time that was not taken in that pay period to be paid at the ordinary rate of pay.
So from that summary, it's really that the definition of training time has remained the same. The scope of where the flags are, of what constitutes training time, has remained unaltered. There is increased flexibility as to how it is delivered. There is more detail with respect to how it is to be recorded, really with a view to the fact that everybody supports and wants to ensure that people do receive the appropriate training time, and it's appropriate that that should be transparent and capable of inspection. So let's go to an example. Taking all of that into account, what's the appropriate payment for a registrar who was rostered to perform 76 hours of ordinary duty, plus 10 hours of training time in a pay period across a pay fortnight, but the registrar is unable to take the training time and perform the work for the 10 hours that was originally rostered for training time? What would the agreement require then?
So if the training time is not able to be reallocated in accordance with the clause...
Only if it can't be reallocated.
Correct. Then the appropriate payment to be made in that pay fortnight would be 76 hours paid at the ordinary rate of pay, the 10 hours paid at the appropriate overtime rate where work was performed above ordinary hours, and the 10 hours of training time that was rostered but was unable to be taken and not allocated in accordance with the clause is to be paid at the ordinary rate of pay.
Daniel, thank you so much for taking us through the training time provision, which is a mix of some new provisions to ensure greater transparency, but really a continuation on of an existing provision. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks, Stuart.